tōmbō mā rē kār chēmbō sēnē dēmbār kīnā yā dōngāmbē rē tē yābō chērā sō hā kōgō yītā rē tēnē tāmbē chū jī nyam nī tē kār chēmbō rē nāngi khyabā tā nāngi dēvā kāmbā tōk tū rē rāngdā yīnā pīn tō bā zō tō rāngdā yīnā pīn tō rāngi tō yīnī dōk tō bā yōng rē tī sēnā chū jī nyam nī tē kār chēmbō rē tē kār chēmbō yīmā hā kōgō tēnē Dani ya pa putte dani na dembar kemba ni ka jama ki ta wi ki na dongam pe mare dani na dembar ki na dongam pe de te ya bo ha ko bu te nyam nyam te ni ha ko bu ye sa are okay
yes yes he said that at the very end, that the appearances of this life are delusions. They are a projection of a deluded mind, not really existing. And therefore, this life is not so important. You know, the things of this life are not all that important. And if you take them as being important, then they cause suffering. Practice of Dharma, listening, reflecting, meditating on the Dharma is important because it benefits both yourself and others and leads to the happiness of both yourself and others. But the appearances of this life are illusory like dreams, and not only are they not important, but if you attached to them, if you get attachment to them, then they cause suffering. And the way that things are in our lives, the same person has both friends and enemies. And if you take the friends and enemies as real, then you have nothing but problems. Whereas if you can see that the friends, based on your study and the practice of the Dharma, if you can see the friends and enemies as being dreamlike, then they don't cause suffering. So in that way, the practice of Dharma has an important effect also on the way that we live our lives and what we get out of them. So he said that it's important to understand that distinction and make sure that one emphasizes the right things in one's life. So then now, today, we arrive at the sixth point under the what was called the support. So we are still talking about the transformation.
Is it fourth? No, only fourth one.
Fourth. It's not six?
No, not here.
No. We have the sixth one.
Yeah.
Last
time we
have
the
third.
Yeah. Fourth or the sixth? No, there's no six.
There's no six.
39. 39. The last, the full understanding.
We're still under that, but I'm thinking of there's 6 points under ne, under the support. We're talking about two different things, so we're both right.
Can I do?
그러니까 sabje ke jo shin.
Right.
Yeah, so what I'm talking about is the six points under support or ground for the transformation. And those are the ones that involve focal requirement, attributes surrendered, application authentic in its mode, defining characteristics, benefits, and full understanding. So under that 6 point, then there are four, right? And we've arrived at the last of those, called complete understanding or full understanding of the effects. And so the root text starts out by saying the last, being the last of those. I better find where we are first. So the last means the last of these 4 points under full understanding, and deals with the effects, meaning what sort of if you get non-conceptual wisdom, then what effect does that have? And those effects are described as being that it has a lasting effect on conceptualization. It affords a happiness which is unsurpassable. It affects elimination of obscurations, both afflicted emotions and obscuration of knowledge. Then the original wisdom attained in the wake of this provides the access to every aspect of knowledge, enables achieving attunement with Buddha fields and thorough maturation of sentient beings, makes viable the revelation as well as the transmission of omniscience itself in its manifold of aspects. These five are the special features of the effects.
Effects.
Effects. Effects. Effects.
Okay.
Laissez. Laissez. Décapsule laissez. 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 Laissez.
Laissez.
Laissez. Laissez. Some to the say le functions. Function. Decaps with effects. So this same word in Tibetan is also translated as function. So what does it mean, a lasting effect on conceptualization? And the term has been translated as if it goes with respect to time, whereas the literal meaning of the Tibetan word gives the picture of the distance. So in the Tibetan way of saying this, it would be that one puts thoughts at a great distance. One gets rid of them, you know, as if they're so far away that they no longer have any effect. And Rinpoche has explained in various contexts that this is the opposite of the five that we talked about before. Yesterday we were talking about this five forms of pseudo-non-conceptuality, with deep lack of the process of thought and correct transcendence and tranquilization and things in their composition and predetermination. Those five all have a limited effect on the process of thought. For example, in tranquilization, an example of that would be deep sleep. So during deep sleep, you don't have any thoughts. So because of that, then one is able to rest, and so you feel fresh the next morning. So it has some sort of an effect on thoughts, but as soon as you wake up, they come back. And the same with the very long sleep-like state of the gods in the Samten levels that achieve, well, it's not really a state of sleep, it's the state of a kind of transcendence of thoughts, in the sense that one is able to repress them or push them down for a long time so that they don't manifest due to the one-pointed samadhi or the one-pointed shamatha practice. But as soon as that samadhi is finished, then the thoughts come back again. But non-conceptual wisdom has this lasting effect. Once you have achieved first bodhisattva level, got direct realization of pure being, then these thoughts do not come back in their coarse form. And as you go up through the bodhisattva levels, then the level of conceptuality becomes finer and finer until finally it's eliminated totally, which only happens at the level of Buddhahood. So there's a certain degree, as I mentioned, there is a certain degree of confusion or a confused state of mind all the way up to Buddhahood. So this first one is called the because it conquers this volatile state we talked about before. We had that term meaning the agitated state of mind of a samsaric mind stream, which always has the tendency to follow its own thoughts and get excited, get disturbed, agitated due to its thoughts and everything that goes with those thoughts. And this whole agitated state of mind is conquered through non-conceptual wisdom. It is conquered, it is completely overcome in the final, at the final end of the transformation. And so this is called the result belonging to a gifted being. So this term, Cheu Zepe Dreu, is one of five types of effects. One talks about the five cause-effect relationships. One takes it, in this case, from the point of view of the result. And one kind of result is called the result of, the result produced by the being. It's called gifted being in this particular context because of the, because of the context. But usually it would be just in the sense of the result produced by the being, sort of the same sort of sense as the man-made result. Because it is the individual, it is the through the effort of the individual in following the path and eliminating the confusion through his own efforts, his or her own efforts, that this result is accomplished. So it's called the man-made result, or the result achieved by a gifted being. To mention here that in general, when Rinpoche was describing what are the effects of non-conceptual wisdom, the final effect, if we draw the line under the whole thing, then the effect would be the direct manifestation of pure being. So that's sort of the sum total of these effects. But then we can take them one at a time and talk about five different types of effects that are produced. So this first one was the man-made result, and the second one is lana mepe dani sak meji dewa terwa zepe. The terwa zepa ni chukun sinjiman lopar tok ching tendu takpe dewa drupet sir dakudreo. The second effect is called the subjective result. And the word subjective here in the Tibetan is dakpo, which literally means the owner. So it's the result that belongs to the owner. And owner means the experiencer. You know, it's a word for the one who is experiencing whatever contents of whatever area of experience that he is confronted with. So since it is the experiencer's result, that result which goes with the experiencer, we call it the subject. I have translated here as subjective result. And the way that it's described is it's affording a happiness of an untainted character, which is unsurpassable because of involving an unmistaken understanding of all phenomena and a lasting accomplishment of permanent happiness. This is the subjective result. So, yes?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello? Is it possible that I announce
something? Sure. Which page will be on? Objective result, and this has to do with happiness. And this is a kind of happiness which doesn't leak. I am really translating the words, I promise. But since everybody here already is weird, I can say a word like that. said some things about this this kind of happiness. The first thing he said about it, it's not the kind of happiness that is tainted or contaminated or leaks away. And that means it's not a happiness created through concepts. It's a happiness arising from non-conceptual wisdom. A happiness arising from concepts is equal to, is the same thing as leaky happiness.
You're right.
Yeah, and then she said a brief remark about this dakpo in this term, dakpo dreyu, the subjective result. Actually, what's being talked about is that non-conceptual wisdom would enable the bodhisattva who has realized it to experience genuine reality. And that kind of experience is not dualistic in the sense of there being an experiencer and something experienced as two different things. So the term could be misleading, but it's used from an ordinary conventional point of view, where we think of there being an experiencer of something. So following that line of thinking, we call this the result that goes with the experiencer, or the subjective result. Then the next one is the dravidreu, the exclusive result, meaning the result which excludes something. In its effecting, its means the non-conceptual wisdom, in its effecting elimination of obscurations, both that of afflicted emotions and the obscuration of knowledge, because these are overcome in their maximal, minimal, and residual stages, this is the exclusive result. So what is it that is actually able to eliminate these two obscurations? We've heard so much about that, about getting rid of them. The agent that actually is able to rid the mind of these two obscurations, of afflicted emotions and obscuration of what it should be known is non-conceptual wisdom. That is what does it. And it does it in a way that gets rid of the whole thing. It overcomes the tra je bakcha dang chepa, it says in Tibetan. And tra literally means the subtle, the very subtle level of it, then the extensive level of it, and then the tenant. Where one talks about a very small cause having a very large effect, like a very small flame can burn down a whole forest. And in this case, it is because the non-conceptual wisdom eliminates the very subtle form of confusion, which is ignorance, or the state of being stupid, timuk, then all of the grosser kind of states that come out of that, it would also eliminate. So actually I can see I have to retranslate this. It doesn't work with minimal or maximal. It doesn't get the picture. But it's more like subtle and gross. So if you get rid of the subtle cause in the form of the of this ignorance, which is subtle in the sense that it's difficult to see, and it's sort of behind the scenes. It's working behind the ordinary workings of things, so it's difficult to catch sight of it. But if you can get rid of that, then you get rid of all of the states of emotional confusion, like the states of anger and jealousy and so on, and all of the suffering that goes with those. And not only will we get rid of the subtle and grosser forms of the obscurations, but also the tendency to repeat them, the habitual patterns, will also be eliminated. So this is exactly the remedy that we have been talking about in many, many different types of teachings. Wherever it is talked about relinquishing the two obscurations, what is needed in order to relinquish them is precisely this non-conceptual wisdom. So that's called the exclusive result. And that name is used because it means that it eliminates what is to be relinquished. So the term is applied from the perspective of something to be eliminated. So it is called the result which excludes that which is to be eliminated, or the exclusive result. So then what is obtained in the wake of that means that we're talking about the post-meditative state now in the following, in what follows. We're going to be talking about post-meditation. So everything that we have had up to this point are the effects of that non-conceptual wisdom which is attained during the meditative equipoise. Oh, I forgot something under the previous one. Sorry, I have so many different things to jump between. I have trouble coordinating it all. But under this point on the exclusive result, Rinpoche talked about the three types of prajna. Because it's a bit ethereal at this point to talk about non-conceptual wisdom as being that which eliminates the obscurations. But then how to contact that? And that is accomplished through the three types of prajna. The prajna arising through listening, listening to teachings. The prajna arising through reflection. Prajna arising through meditation. And Rinpoche compared it to it's like washing clothes. But if you have, if your clothes are all dirty, then if you put them into clean water and use soap, then you can get them back into a nice shape again, nice form. You can get remove all of the dirt so that they become nice and fresh. And that's the type of image that is meant to be conveyed by talking about an exclusive result. It's the result which gets rid of the dirt in the clothes, or in the mind, in this case. Still understood, of course, as the circumstantial stains, not any sort of imperfection that has been in the mind itself. But nevertheless, these obscurations have to be removed if one is to experience that fundamental mind. So, the original wisdom of the post-meditative state, which unmistakably understands the concrete characteristic of all phenomena, and which is attained in the wake of this non-conceptual wisdom of the meditative state of equipoise, whose effects are described above, provides the access to an unhindered insight into every aspect of knowledge, thus comprising the reciprocal result. So to go through the sentence from the beginning, this lasting effect on conceptualization, the unsurpassable happiness, and the removal of the obscurations of emotions and knowledge occurs through the non-conceptual wisdom of the meditative state. And what occurs as an effect of the non-conceptual wisdom functioning during the post-meditative state is omniscience. That is to say, knowledge, access to every aspect of knowledge, achieving attunement with Buddha feels, being able to mature beings completely, and being able to know the teaching within one's own mind stream fully, and to transmit it to others. So all of this, these last mentioned are effects of the post-meditative state of non-conceptual wisdom, or that wisdom as it's functioning in the post-meditative state. So here, the term, so it says, the original wisdom which unmistakably understands the concrete characteristic of all phenomena. And here, the concrete characteristic does not mean the entity as such, the concrete characteristics of entities, like they're being red and small, all these ordinary sort of attributes. What it means here by concrete characteristic is the actual nature. So it's not that aspect of things which seems to exist being produced through materials or consisting of materials. It's not that kind of concrete characteristic, but it is the nature of things, and that's called a concrete characteristic because it's what's actually there. And because it's actually there, it can be genuinely experienced, whereas the relative aspects of the dualistic appearance are not actually there. They are something non-existent appearing, so they cannot actually be experienced. They can only be experienced in a deluded way as a kind of dreamlike, confused state. But since this original wisdom understands their real concrete characteristic, their genuine nature, then the appearance aspect of it does not cause any suffering within the mind. So whether the, and in this case one would be talking about a bodhisattva who has realized this wisdom, and even though that such a bodhisattva would experience various appearances like friends and enemies and other contradictory appearances, there would be a lack of suffering to the same degree that genuine nature has been realized. So again, one should keep in mind that it is not, a realized bodhisattva is not the same as a Buddha, even though there's realization. There is still some degree of confused state of mind, or as I said, there's some slight remnant of this, some slight suffering, shall we say, subtle suffering.
But I thought that the suffering is on the first bodhisattva,
yeah, the gross level of suffering and gross level of delusion is finished and doesn't come back. But we've also heard that the first bodhisattva level is not the ultimate transformation. And that bears with it the fact that even the realized bodhisattva has not reached the end of the path and still has things to learn and still makes mistakes and still has things to go through, right? And unpleasant states of mind to cope with. And it's good to keep in mind because we have a tendency as Westerners to deify the bodhisattvas, to think of them as gods, you know, as perfect, as having no errors and no kind of problems at all to cope with. And if one thinks of them that way, one can get into problems. If one sees them making certain errors or seeming to have certain problems, then it can shake your faith. You know, it can confuse you completely if you're already thinking of them as being like absolutely perfect, which is not the case. So this is a very realistic kind of statement that's being made, and one should take it realistically. It's another question when one's talking about the Vajrayana path. Then one sees the Lama as being a Buddha, and that's important for one's own realization. You know, the kind of faith that is required in order to get the result in the Vajrayana has to be an extremely thorough kind of faith, complete faith. And so that's another context.
But I thought even in Mahayana you have to accept your teacher from whom you get the teachings as a Buddha, but is it possible to separate when you get teachings and if you not get the teachings? But that's actually not possible.
No, in the Sutrayana tradition, you know, in the Mahayana level, one doesn't look at the teacher as a Buddha. Say, Gewashenin, right? Mm-hmm. Gewashenin is the spiritual friend, the spiritual guide, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what meant by Buddha? Because to be a Buddha, Buddha. And he came, I mean, it's like we're all the Buddha, and that's the Lama realizes it. So we think of him as the Buddha, right? We think, you know, that is our Buddha nature.
Mm.
We're related to it directly. Mm. But if you think, oh, you know, you read about that, the Buddha, and, you know, what about the Buddha?
Yeah.
You might again get confused. And
yes.
This person doesn't seem to be another person like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, even in the Vajrayana context, the perception of the belief in the Lama as like being the Buddha is not as a historical Buddha. It's not a Buddha who performs the 12 deeds.
But also, it's not the sense that he's the Buddha in the sense. It's like the Buddha is reality, and the Lama is sort of directly expressing that reality.
There's a very nice statement on this in the Kadampa tradition. It's not the person, it's the teaching.
But it is the person as well, because it's
along the same lines that you're thinking, that one shouldn't start thinking too personally about this.
It is a Buddha, but if you get too personal about it, you again have any doubt.
Yeah, and it can cause a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very nice treatment of this whole subject in the Nirinjamsa, in the Mahamudra, ninth Kalapas Mahamudra text. It was talking about the special preliminaries. And there are these four special preliminaries, where one of them is called the intermediary condition, which is the Lama, as the intermediary between where one is at now and where one is trying to get, you know, between. And it's the trigger, yeah. Yeah. And under that point, there are four different types of lama that are mentioned. Lama in the form of a member of a lineage, human lama as a member of a lineage. Lama in the form of the words of the Buddha. Lama in the form of the symbolic appearance. And the lama in the form of the ultimate nature of mind, pure being. And the first is the relative lama, the person who belongs to a lineage is relative lama, and the last, the lama in the form of pure being, is the real lama. Nevertheless, the text there mentions that, you know, which of these four types of lama, which is the most important? It's the lama, the human lama, who has a lineage, because it's through him that you realize the other three. So.
So not personally, the personal lama is the most important.
Yeah.
Because the other three have always been there
anyway. Yeah, and we've never seen it.
It's been not good to us at all.
So then this particular point is called the reciprocal result. And what that means is that the result that you get out of it fits with the cause. So what does it say about this? In the commentary, the original wisdom which unmistakably understands the concrete characteristic of all phenomena and which is attained in the wake of this non-conceptual wisdom provides the access to an unhindered insight into every aspect of knowledge, thus comprising the reciprocal result. So since the result is insight, then the cause that fits with that is the three types of prajna. Prajna arising through listening, reflecting, and meditating. Pardon? The prajna arising through reflection. That means... it means the certainty that you gain in your understanding through having reflected over what you have listened to. You know, it doesn't mean the just the ordinary process of thinking about something and then you get it sort of clear, and then you forget it more or less afterwards. And you know, it's not that kind of reflection. The to talk about it as the samsungi sherab, the prajna that comes from reflecting, that's the final result of reflection. The certainty that you have in your mind, in your understanding of those teachings that you have heard. And Rinpoche said that, you know, if it... the idea of this reciprocal result is that there has to be a correspondence between the result achieved and the cause that produced it. If one were to say that one could get the insight of realization without having listened and reflected and done the studies, and then on the basis of that certainty coming from having studied, to reflect, to meditate, then, but instead of that, that the insight just sort of popped up without any, you know, just sort of one day all of a sudden by itself, just came. But then there wouldn't be any correspondence between the result and the cause. So the this kind of result of insight has to be preceded by gaining that insight, by producing the cause for our insight, which is listening, reflecting, and meditating. He has mentioned before that it doesn't always happen in the same lifetime, but it has to have happened. To get the insight, there must be study as a cause.
You can have it,
it does happen, yeah, for it's called Wangpo Rap.
You know.
Yeah, probably. So, otherwise we wouldn't be attracted and wouldn't have the karma to reconnect with it. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, that's there to help us along the way, what the work that we have done previously. But the one talks about three levels of capacity, Wangpo, Tring, and Tama, the highest, the middle, and the other one. The other kind. And if you are a being of highest capacity, then you can get realization like that, right? But that means that you've done all of the, you produced the cause in a previous life. Then, so, what happens next? It furthermore, it, meaning non-conceptual wisdom functioning in the post-meditative state, enables the achieving of complete attunement with Buddha fields and the thorough maturation of sentient beings, and makes viable, and makes it possible, the revelation and development to completion within one's own mind stream, as well as the transmission to others of the phenomenon of omniscience itself in its many manifold of aspects. We heard last night Shantideva's wish that through the merit, through the rain, as it were, may the rain coming from the rain of the merit collected, the rain of, may the rain falling from the clouds of the merit collected in a way which is free of focal referent, pacify the torment of the suffering of being burned by fire, which all beings experience. And this is the same type of thing that is being said here, that one is able to and then it ended up by saying, may I teach them the emptiness because of this merit, may I be able to teach them the emptiness. So first one gets the development of omniscience in all of its aspects, complete knowledge, in all these aspects, in one's own mind stream, then you can transmit it to others. So these three together constitute the fully matured result. It's called the fully matured result because it's like the final result from the causes produced. So let's recite that verse. The last, the full understanding of its effects includes outline. Now we're finished with the support and the 6 points that were under that and all of the subdivisions. So now we go back to the seventh. So that point, the support, was number six. The seventh was mental cultivation. So the introduction to that, for individuals wishing to cross the threshold into original non-conceptual wisdom, for any bodhisattva, awakening hero, this is the way to cultivate the mind. Rinpoche's commentary on that was that what follows here is an introduction into the procedure involved in the mental cultivation of complete transformation. And what does that mean? Mental cultivation of transformation. It means how do you think? What sort of a way does the bodhisattva think? That's what it means. And the reason why we're mentioning this is that the point is to actually accomplish the transformation. So in order to accomplish it, one has to know how to think properly. What sort of, what should one's mentality be like, one's attitude, one's whole approach to things? It has to do with concept. This is a relative level of things. How one, the yi here in yi la zepa is the rational mind. Right? So how is one thinking in order to be able to accomplish the transformation? And of course, those who are not interested in accomplishing the transformation would not think like this, and they wouldn't see any reason for thinking like this.
Isn't now a description of the non-dual way of thinking?
Well, we'll see. That's the surprise. Now I have to find which page we're on again. Keeps getting away. So, it is designed for individuals wishing to find the way to cross the threshold into original non-conceptual wisdom, which serves as the support for this transformation. So in other words, it is for those who want to accomplish that. If you have that wish to accomplish the non-conceptual wisdom, then one will be able to follow the logic of this. For anyone who is a bodhisattva, which means awakening hero, this is the way to cultivate the mind. So here we're specifying what sort of a being is able to think like this. You have to be a bodhisattva, otherwise it's not going to make any sense. Because the suchness, the fundamental ground of all phenomena, yet remains unknown, the so-called all-inclusive base consciousness, also known as the store of all seeds of phenomena whose appearance as perceived and perceiver, is a complete imputation on the part of the deluded intellect in spite of their being untrue, is that which constitutes the cause of the appearance of perceived and perceiver as two, which occurs in spite of the fact that these do not exist. So, what does that mean? It means that
Yila sepa
lepsong te dela kunshi namshi.
Dela
Ah, kya le lepsong? Oh, yeah. Ta yi se pa kena thar bo ke. Ta ga tu ge?
La.
Oh, yeah.
Ta ga re
be? Sa ga re.
And she said, now we have to get clear. We have to get clear about how to do this mental cultivation. What is the way of thinking involved in order to accomplish the transformation? So we have to get this clear now. So it is the all-based consciousness, the Alaya Vijnana, which is called the store of all seeds. That means it is that all-based consciousness in which the seeds for everything that is experienced dualistically are stored. And this is the case for all phenomena. And it is because one does not know the suchness or the fundamental ground of all phenomena, but is merely experiencing the deluded appearance. And since that deluded appearance seems to be a true dualism, where there really is an object to be perceived separate from the perceiving mind, because it appears like that, then one just takes it as being true. One assumes that it is like that. So even though it is not, from the perspective of the deluded intellect, there is this imputation of phenomena as appearing in the form of perceived and perceiver. Imputation means that one thinks of them as actually existing in the way that they seem to exist. And that's just an imputation. It's just one's own way of thinking. And that way of thinking... So that is the activity of mind at the present time. So we're trying to figure out what sort of activity should be going on in our minds as bodhisattvas who want to accomplish non-conceptual wisdom. And what's going on at the present time in a deluded state is that one has the idea of perceived and perceiver, which is connected with all phenomena that appear, as being something real. And because one takes it in that way, then it makes seeds. It produces seeds. And these seeds are stored in the all-based consciousness. And this is the store place, the storehouse for that which does not exist, but nevertheless appears as a duality of perceived and perceiver. Then how can it be that this dualistic appearance is occurring if it doesn't actually exist? This appearance takes the form of the variety of phenomena manifesting from nowhere other than the stream of consciousness. And that stream of consciousness has been conditioned by oneself and by one's own habitual tendencies, fabricated throughout beginningless time like a dream. So that's why these non-existent phenomena appear. Because through taking them as real, one has planted the seed of that type of dualistic mentality in one's own mind, and when it ripens out of that mind in the form of dualistic appearances, then one again through that habit takes them as being real, again planting the seed. So it continues in a circle like that from throughout beginningless time. With that all-based consciousness, which in some texts also appears under the name mind-stream, so all-based consciousness doesn't mean anything else except mind-stream, the total sum of what you have in your mind. And with that all-based consciousness as the support, the necessary grounds are provided for the diversification of consciousness into any of its operative forms. And with that emerges what appear to be the separate perceiving principles, with each its own object towards which it bears a non-transferable relation. So the support here is the all-based consciousness, and the diversification of consciousness means the sevenfold collection. So that means the sensory consciousnesses and the rational mind and the afflicted mentality. So all seven of those are the diversification of consciousness. I mean, actually it's only one consciousness, right? But conventionally it can be looked at through these in these eight ways, where the all base is the support. And when you have that storehouse of all those dualistic seeds, then they diversify when they manifest into all of these different types of objects, like forms, and the eye consciousness that experiences them, and the eye faculty through which the experience happens. All of those are manifested out of the all-based consciousness. And when it happens like that, the relation between consciousness and object is non-transferable. That means that the eye consciousness cannot transfer its operations to the ear. So the ear cannot see forms. And the ear cannot transfer its operations to the eye. So the eye cannot hear sounds. And this is an important point, because it tends to strengthen the apparent reality of the objects perceived, since we always perceive forms through an eye consciousness and always sounds through the ear. It tends to strengthen the idea of their being objectively existent in that way.
Oh, you think if one also could perceive eye objects which are normally perceived through the eye with the ear, then that would make them less real or less...
In fact, realized bodhisattvas have this ability, that all the operations of all five sensory faculties can be performed by any of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sorry. To hear with the eye.
So they can really be all ears.
They can be all ears. And that's because the you know, this they're being limited to one sense faculty like that is part of the delusion. It's part of the conceptual habit. And when you're not taking that habit so seriously, then consciousness can look out of any hole, right? Whether it's an ear hole or an eye hole.
And you don't how they hold it, like have this kind of ability to see, hear, and so on.
Pardon?
Not only the senses, but all their body has this ability.
Also their body, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So, due to us being that which does not exist that appears, through the power of incorrect interpretation, the cause, the all-base, and its effects, the sevenfold collection, together with their objects, manifest as well. Even though in the eyes of delusion, these do appear as such phenomena, taking the form of dualistically appearing perceived and perceiver. They do not exist in reality, but are merely one's own incorrect interpretation, as is the case with mirage and so on. So then what happens when you've got that, right? So that's the explanation of how the mind got deluded. That's a very precise description of how the delusion occurs. And if you know that, then you will also know how liberation occurs. So that's the importance of knowing this and being able to start thinking in this way, because it enables you to get liberated. In order to get to know how to get liberated, you first have to know how the delusion functions. Then you can correct it. Yeah, as Rinpoche said, if you know how the delusion occurs and therefore how liberation can come to happen, then you know the path. You're able to follow a path going to that destination. So in fact, the path is created exactly by knowing how you got confused and then gradually, step by step, correcting that. With that dualism of perceived and perceiver appearing, pure being does not appear. So it functions as a kind of magnet, you know, or it completely occupies the consciousness. So as long as one is experiencing things as perceived and perceiver duality, then pure being does not appear. And this is true not only in the waking state, but in the dream state. As soon as any appearances occur in the mind, one immediately, instinctively, reacts to them as if they are truly existent. And that obscures their pure being, their nature. Through that percept and perceiver, that object and subject not appearing, pure being indeed appears. To say this means that it is through such cultivation of mind, when properly done, it has to be done correctly, then with the knowledge of the sentient being cycling in samsara without seeing pure being due to incorrect interpretation, that the bodhisattva steps for the first time across the brink into original non-conceptual wisdom, because there is no more profound key to an unambiguous understanding of afflictive factors than this insight into the appearance of samsara having no other cause whatsoever than concept. And the most profound of all keys to the path, on which refining factors are accomplished in practice, is to know that dualistic appearance, in not existing as it seems, is merely an incorrect concept, thus abandoning the assumption of its having the determinative quality assigned it, thereby penetrating non-conceptual original wisdom. So we have to try to look at the sentence again. So it's placing the cause of samsara in one's own mind, and the way that mind is functioning, the way you're using the mind. And Rinpoche said, samsara, your samsara, is not created by some god like Vishnu or Brahma and so on, and your liberation will not be created by them either. Since your delusion is not created by gods, your liberation cannot be created by gods. Nor is it created by demons. You know, the delusion that you're in, this state of torment in samsara, it's not some very nasty demons who are playing this trick on you. Also, it doesn't arise through no causes and no conditions, just sort of completely randomly for no reason, that you're just confused. And if it was like that, then of course you couldn't correct it at all. So because it is not produced by gods, nor by demons, and does not arise without a cause and condition, then we still have the question of, well, then where does it come from? And that's what we get as the answer here, that it's an incorrect interpretation. So what appears as real, we believe is real. And when one is able to see that in fact it is not real, then that appearance will subside into the expanse of Dharma Dhatu, free of the duality of perceived and perceiver. And Amishi said that this does not mean literally that realization means that all appearances disappear. You know, when he used the example of the flower on his table there, he said, if you realize that the appearance of the flower is that it is manifesting due to mind, that it is a product of habitual patterns, and that its true nature is free of any duality of perceived and perceiver, like a flower in a dream. If you realize that, then the appearance of the flower does not disappear.
I forgot to come back and tell you, didn't you say that? Yeah.
Quarter past.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we have 2 minutes. We'll make it. So it doesn't mean that when you realize that the appearance of the flower disappears. You know, so a minute ago it was there, then you realize its true nature, and then it's gone. Right?